Nice to see everyone today. And so nice to have had all that sunshine. I wish it would come back. But I have something else to brighten our day. This is a reading from the Kabir book, translated by Robert Bly, the poems of Kabir, a poet from India. I don't know what kind of God we've been talking about. The caller calls in a loud voice to the Holy One at dusk. Why? Surely the Holy One is not deaf. He hears the delicate anklets that ring on the feet of an insect as it walks. Go over and over your beads. Paint weird designs on your forehead. Wear your hair matted, long and ostentatious. But when deep inside you, there's a loaded gun, how can you have God? Beautiful poem, isn't it? We get immediately what the poet is talking about, even if some of the details are unclear. But certain trained readers, by which I mean those who have been trained by others or trained themselves to feel insulted or harmed when they read anything that seems non-congratulatory about their identity group or about themselves, this lovely poem is a string full not of beads, but of pointed challenges to what you might call spiritual virtue signaling. The caller, who calls in a loud voice to the Holy One at dusk, can be read as a muezzin, calling Muslims to prayer from the minaret of a mosque. Worshippers with long dreadlocks and designs painted on their foreheads back in Kabir's India were probably Hindus. Almost every major religious tradition uses prayer beads, and I can imagine my great aunt Philomena scowling and preparing to hurl one of her salty Southern Italian curses at anyone who dared insult her daily communications with the Mother of God via her string of beads and endless Ave Marias. Kabir was an equal opportunity seeker and an equal opportunity tweaker of cranky tendencies in religion and spirituality. Though raised in a poor family of Muslim weavers, he asked to study with a famous Hindu teacher. The teacher refused to listen or to initiate him as a disciple because that would involve physical contact. You have to do that to be initiated. And this great master felt that he would be spiritually harmed by touching a Muslim. So one night, Kabir lay on the steps of a temple while the teacher was praying inside. Coming out in the darkness, he stepped on Kabir, who said, "Ah, now that you've initiated me, you'll have to teach me what you know." And now that I've told you that, let's listen to Deborah play. Thank you, Deborah. Well, I know that this was the first time I've shared that poem by Kabir with you. I'm guessing it's the first time that some of you have heard it, but I'm sure that most of you have heard the Dr. Seuss classic, Scrambled Egg Super, before, and today is definitely not the first time that I've read it to our kids on a Sunday morning. Some years earlier, I had shared it at another church at the start of the service, and carry on with my reading and sermon, and then it was time to share our candles of joy and sorrow. A visitor, fringe jacket, blonde dreadlocks, and those silver mirror sunglasses that are rarely a good sign when they're worn indoors, lit a candle and then fixed me fast with a gaze like that of the bombastic aghast and told us how he wanted to be part of a church where people respect nature, not one where the minister teaches children to steal eggs from the nests of wild birds. He was serious, super serious. I waited for him to finish, projecting patience and calm, while at the same time, part of me wished that I could hop on a Jilika Jast who would run like a deer and get me home fast while I steered him by ear. I'd just been attacked with a candle of smear. Was he seriously aghast at the story or just being bombastic? Did he really believe excuse me, that there were real birds somewhere that lay eggs three times their own size, or birds whose legs are so long that their eggs always break after dropping 20 feet, or that Peter traveled the world to gather his eggs while his nest-robbing agent sent more from faraway deserts or even 10 miles north of the North Pole to add to the first eggs he had in his bowl, and did all this while his pan was heating on the stove? Or is it possible that Dr. Seuss is sharing a world of imagination, a world of play, with what the mouth can say and the mind can find and sort and blend and scramble? Or was he taking a gamble that someone else might join him in calling me out? Maybe they'd shout, "We must save the birds from egg-stealing turds like bad Reverend Morrow and his bad, hurtful words." If that's how he used candle sharing, which is designed as a way to be ritually kind, who knows how he might picture our church on nastier platforms like Twitter or Yelp? I can't help but wonder, though I didn't go look, this fish has no wish to bite such a hook. Okay, sorry for all the silly rhyming and for just now mixing poultry with seafood at a time when so many of us are as serious about our diets as we are about so many things. And seriously, I don't mean to suggest that these things are unimportant or that all of this seriousness just hatched yesterday out of some kind of weird cosmic bird's eggs. Back to seafood, to 1978, and to an all-school meeting at Star King School for Religious Leadership in Berkeley, California, where so many ministers have prepared for service in Unitarian Universalist congregations. All school meetings were just that: students, faculty, administrators, and everyone who had a place and an interest in the school. Teddy the custodian was there, a Black former middleweight boxer and jazz musician whose band Teddy and the All-Stars played at school parties, an upbeat ensemble that included Bob Kimball, our president, on clarinet. Bob wore other hats just like Teddy did. Bob had been the student and close confidant of Paul Tillich, one of the 20th century's foremost theologians, and now served as the literary executor of Tillich's vast legacy of unpublished writings. He occasionally led classroom seminars, but the most difficult course at the school to enter and to navigate was his one-on-one tutorial in theology, where he might assign anything from one of Tillich's works to The Little Prince or Rollo May's Love and Will. He would tell the secretary, no calls. You'd go inside with him, he'd close the door, and the two of you would sit down together. He would talk, and you would listen. You would talk, and he would listen, really listen. You would emerge 2 hours later holding what some lovingly called a Kimballgram, a few words on unlined paper written with different colored fine tip marking pens. You would emerge sometimes shaken, sometimes shocked, but always supported. Once he asked me if I was thinking of returning to what he saw as the endless horrors of India, just to avoid dealing with some unpleasantness in my life in the US. Once he wrote on my Kimballgram the words, deepest compassion. Though as a raider of wild birds' nests, among my other cruel hobbies like fishing, I didn't and still don't really see myself that way. I hope there's something to it. Well, sorry, we were supposed to be in the middle of an all-school meeting, not my private tutorial. Bob was moving towards making a point about leadership at that meeting, telling us about a dinner he'd had with several other seminary presidents at Spenger's, Berkeley's most famous seafood restaurant out by the bay. He and these other illustrious heads of institutions had decided that before the main course, they would start with a round of oysters. I think he meant raw and on the half shell. Anyway, he said they arrived quickly and, quote, they were delicious. We all knew that he was now coming to his point, and this point would be a wonderful one about religious leadership, something we all needed to know. Before he could get there, however, One student rose, flashed a look of fury around the room, and staged a walkout. A one-person walkout from an all-school meeting is quite noticeable at a school that only has 30-some students, like Star King did back then. We soon learned that the walkout had been staged in protest of the mention of eating oysters. This student was a vegetarian, and this was the first that I'd heard about it, though some others had heard it before. The student certainly assumed that Bob had heard. What a monster he was for sharing his pleasure in eating the bodies of small animals that were technically still alive. It was the talk of the school for the next several days. And I thought now that I had an answer to a question that had been on my mind since I first visited the school. There was a big tree right in front. A large root had lifted a slab of sidewalk, creating a tripping hazard and a difficult barrier for wheelchairs. That root had been carefully cut, and new cement had recently been poured. And someone had written "murderers" in capital letters with an exclamation point when the cement was fresh, plus an arrow pointing to the root stump. Now I felt sure that I had a pretty good idea about who might have done it, though I couldn't be completely sure. But I do feel pretty sure that whoever wrote that word in the sidewalk, shaming the delicate work of the arborist and defacing the craftsmanship of the concrete finisher, thought that they were calling out an act of violence, of deliberate harm. The student who disrupted our meeting with that walkout was calling out violence against oysters, or at least they thought they were. And the visitor who disrupted our sharing of joys and sorrows thought he was calling me out for teaching children to do violence, to harm birds by raiding their nests and scrambling their eggs. Hashtag Peter T. Cooper is a murderer. Recently, the New York Times science section featured a story about two men, Mohammed Saud and Nadim Shehzad, who have been devoting their lives and fortunes to the strange sounding project of rescuing kites in New Delhi from kites. The first kind of kite is a dark feathered raptor related to hawks and eagles, very common in northern India. The second kind is the sort that's flown on a string and is named after such birds. Kite fighting is a centuries old pastime in India, using strings that have been encrusted with sharp bits of broken glass. The idea is to fly your kite close to another one, and then with a deft movement, use your string to cut through that of your competitor. Off it goes in the wind and you win. Great fun, but also dangerous in a dense city like New Delhi. About a dozen people are killed each year by sharp falling strings that whip around their necks, motorcyclists, rickshaw drivers, sometimes young children. Thousands and thousands of birds, especially those hawk-like kites, also have had their wings slashed. Mohammed and Nadim do their best to rescue as many as possible from real harm and what can be a slow and painful death. But now things get a little tricky. Kites are extremely common, like pigeons in other cities. Dark colored, handsome in a hawkish way, but not colorfully pretty birds. And there's another problem. Kites scavenge whatever they can from the city's garbage heaps, but they are basically meat eaters. There's a long established charity bird hospital in Delhi that's run by Jains, a small minority religion that's little known outside of India, but very influential. Jainism was the first among Indian religions to develop the idea of ahimsa, or nonviolence, an idea that later spread among many Buddhists and Hindus. Observant Jains will watch their step carefully to avoid stepping on worms after rain, won't swat mosquitoes, and sometimes wear gauze masks to keep from inhaling even the smallest of insects. I don't think I could ever maintain such a scrupulous, nonviolent practice, though I can certainly respect the careful approach to life that it encourages. But when Muhammad and Nadim tried bringing injured kites to Charity Bird Hospital, they were turned away. Hospital staff would not handle meat and so could not feed or otherwise care for the carnivorous birds. Nadim wondered, when it came to creatures like birds, why is there discrimination between a vegetarian and a non-vegetarian? Like most other Muslims, both men eat meat themselves. And Nadim says of the refusal, it hit us somewhere inside because we were non-vegetarian ourselves. I think it would hit me that way too. It's as if the strictly vegetarian bird hospital folks think that kites really shouldn't eat meat, as if they're doing something wrong by simply being raptors. The brothers have become expert at caring for the injured birds themselves, though they lose quite a few of their patients. And I almost lost my patients a few days later when I read another story coming not from India, but from Pennsylvania. Margot, a six-year-old girl with Down syndrome, had for some reason, or maybe maybe no reason, made a finger gun gesture at her teacher during a classroom session. And so instead of calling Margot's parents, the police had been summoned to her elementary school to respond to this threat of gun violence. Her mother wrote to the school board, "I am well aware that we live in a time when parents are concerned for their children's safety in school." She acknowledges the real harm, the horrific fear and suffering caused by school shootings like those at Sandy Hook Elementary and Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High Schools, and then continues, "But I also think our society and our schools across the country have overreacted with respect to perceived threats, resulting in even finger guns wielded by kindergartners being viewed as a cause to alert authorities and to cause confusion, fear, and again, real harm to a child with mental and developmental challenges like those that Margot faces." Where do you think we should locate any violence in this situation? The child? In her finger? In her mom? The school? Or the police? What do all of these stories have in common? The visitor who disrupts a religious service to decry violence in an imaginative story about two children and some imaginary birds? The very real birds whose damaged bodies a bird hospital refuses to heal because these birds eat meat and so fail to follow a human religious prohibition? Disrupting a story that involves eating oysters as if someone had just forced a dozen raw ones down your throat? Spoiling the work of a concrete finisher and charging an arborist with murder for trying to make a sidewalk safer because, yes, that involved cutting a tree root. Peter T. Hooper speculates that southwest-facing cranes might have something wrong with their brains. I don't think I'm qualified to make such a diagnosis about the people involved in any of these situations, but there's something going on here that I'm tempted to call nonviolence pursued in a bombastic manner that borders on violence, harmful anti-harmfulness, or just violent nonviolence, maybe. But to be honest, those feel a bit like fighting words, and I don't want to have a fight or to draft you into a war against anyone or anything. That's not our purpose here, or the purpose of any religion. I think our friend Kabir said it best 500 years ago. Go over and over your beads, paint weird designs on your forehead, wear your hair matted, long, and ostentatious. But when deep inside you, there's a loaded gun, how can you have God? Deep inside you, in your hearts, perhaps, or maybe your brains. Now, is there something that eggs, oysters, and even brains have in common? What would you say that something is? There are very important reasons why eggs and oysters both have shells, why brains have skulls. We could also say that there are reasons why shells have eggs or oysters, why skulls have brains, why nails have fingers, and why teeth have tongues and lips. Even vegetarian foods must be bitten and chewed if they're to be digested. Hard and soft are parts of a continuous natural whole. The interplay of hard and soft is essential for life, real life, in the real world. Years before Kabir's time, someone else in India wrote a book called the Chandogya Upanishad. Upanishad means simply sitting down next to someone and listening, really listening, while giving them the chance to speak. No rush, no urgency. You give them the time to begin and the time to finish, just like you'd wait for a bird to lay an egg or for that egg to hatch. Here's what the Chandogya Upanishad says. In the beginning, this, all this, was non-existent. Then it became existent. It grew. It turned into an egg. The egg lay for the period of a year. Then it broke open. Of the two halves of the eggshell, one half was of silver, the other of gold. That which was of silver became the earth. That which was of gold, heaven. What was the thick membrane of the white became the mountains? The thin membrane of the yolk became the mist and clouds. The veins became the rivers, the fluid in the bladder, the ocean, and what was born of it was the sun. When it was born, shouts of hurrah arose together with all beings and all objects of desire. Therefore, at its rise and its every return, shouts of hurrah together with all beings and all objects of desire arise. The silver and gold halves of a shell, the thin membrane behind it, the yolk, the veins that tell us the egg was fertilized, the clear white and the yolk, yes, all are precious. All are sacred. And so was the breaking and all that came after, the scrambled egg super that make up our world. We would never know that if we had stood up and walked out at the sound of the first crack. You'll notice that there's no mention of a cosmic chicken in this story of the cosmic egg, so you must be delighted to know the answer to that age-old riddle about which came first. But seriously, I love the good cheer that we can hear in this reading, a cheer from 2,400 years ago that echoes the supportive cheer of joy at the birth of the sun, and then goes on echoing until this very day as we prepare to cheer again tomorrow. In a time when it has become common to call each other out or to put each other down, may we first sit down next to each other and hear each other through. Let people talk and let people finish. That's rarely, if ever, going to harm you. What we hear at first may sound like nothing but cracking, breaking, things pouring out and getting mixed up. But if you give the storyteller time for the whole thing to emerge, you might hear something that will make you shout, hurrah! Something simply super, like what we are served by Peter T. Hooper. So may it be.
Oh, thanks, Craig. I invite you now into the spirit of meditation and prayer. Close your eyes if you wish. Move into a position that is comfortable for your body and breathe. As we pause and consider the words and stories we heard today, I invite you into the space we have made in our worship together to honor and reflect upon both the great joys and great sorrows we carry in our hearts. Let us hold quiet together in preparation for listening deeply.